KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. In his last weeks on the job, UC President Mark Udoff talks with us about a tempestuous tenure marked by deep budget cuts, steep tuition hikes, and controversial campus protests.
The people of California rightly expect us to handle it well, and they shouldn't be blaming the students or the people coming in to protest. They judge us more, and that's okay, and we could have done better.
Also, predictive policing, using math to fight crime in L.A.
After that initial report gets filed, then the model says, hey, there's a risk of after crimes or aftershocks. And then the police go into that area, and then they prevent those second and third crimes from occurring.
Plus, he brought Catholicism to California, but at a high price. Junipero Serra will examine a new exhibit. It's the California Report. Across California this week, colleges and universities came to life as students shook off summer and headed back to class. At University of California campuses, it's a season of change. UC President Mark Udoff steps down at the end of the month. It's been a very tough few years for Udoff and UC with all of California's budget problems. We'll talk with President Udoff about that and more in a minute, but first, we headed to UC campuses to hear how students are feeling about the kind of university Udoff is leaving them.
As a senior, being on three waiting lists out of the four classes that I'm taking is really, really frustrating. The inability to get the classes that I need to graduate because there are more students than there are classes is really frustrating.
I wouldn't say that I agree with all of the adjustments that were made, but I have a really hard time imagining that anybody dealing with that kind of financial circumstance would have gotten rave reviews everywhere.
That was Teresa Costa at UC Davis and Nikolai Durang-Stearns at UC Berkeley. We also asked students about the outsider who's going to replace Mark Udoff at the end of the month, former Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. Here's what UC San Diego student Erica Fontana had to say.
It seems to me like kind of a strange choice because it's an educational institution and she's coming from a sort of political, military-ish background. And I'm not really sure what direction that's going to take UCSD.
Janet Napolitano takes over for Udoff after 5 years of steep budget cuts, soaring tuition, and more than a little controversy over compensation packages for UC execs, including Udoff. He came to UC from the University of Texas, the first outsider chosen to lead UC in more than a century. He started in 2008, inheriting a university beset by financial scandals and allegations of mismanagement. In his 12th-story office in downtown Oakland this week, the 68-year-old Udoff seemed relaxed but tired. His tenure began just as the economy was crashing, and I asked him what, if anything, surprised him when he got here.
The general contours, I think, I knew. We were in a recession. Budgets would be very tight. We had a strong tradition, which I appreciate, of shared governance, so I knew it was a very flat, non-hierarchical type of organization. But there were dimensions to it that surprised me. And one dimension was it was the worst economic crisis since the 1930s. I didn't expect it to be that long, that deep, that severe. I didn't expect $1 billion in budget reductions. I thought, you know, maybe a few hundred million dollars. I knew we had labor unions. But I would say that, the relations were more difficult than I anticipated. Prior to coming to California, I'd never had a Regents meeting closed down by demonstrators. Here, half our meetings are closed down.
As you said, there have been about $1 billion in cuts, some under Schwarzenegger, most of them under Jerry Brown. Is that a failure of someone's leadership or a failure to appreciate the university? I mean, we've seen prison spending going up and spending for other things. Why is support for UC going down the way it has?
Part of it is we're part of the discretionary budget. We don't have matching funds in Washington. Part of it is there is more skepticism toward higher education. Part of it is that when you're having to cut human services like dental care for indigent young people, it really puts it to you because people are suffering in the here and now, and education is more of a long-term investment. I think it's partly the demographics. We in California have more Hispanic kids and to educate. That's the demographic I'm most concerned about, students of color who deserve the same sort of break that Earl Warren got. But it's an aging population that votes worries more about Social Security and health care and a lockbox. And I think the taxpayers, they should be saying those Hispanic kids are our kids, even if they're not in our family, and we should tax ourselves to pay for their education and not necessarily burden the families with debt and all the rest of it to get them through.
There was a point in early 2011 where the amount of funds from tuition surpassed the amount of funds from the state.
For the first time in our history, the amount of funds from tuition, not by a huge margin, but significant margin, exceeded the state contribution. This was sort of at the bottom of the trough.
Yeah. And in your statement, you said this is a sad day for California. What were you thinking when you wrote that?
Because I don't think education is a private good. It's a hybrid. It is, if you get a good education and you get a good job, bully for you, good for your family, good for their health care, good for their income, good for your children. But it's also great when we turn out people who are productive and pay taxes and people who do not commit crimes and people who do great works of art and write wonderful books and people who are doing research on alternative fuels and all the rest. So it has aspects of a public good and aspects of a private good. And the more you treat it simply as a private good and say, hey, we don't care. If you want to get a good education, it's all up to you. I think that's a pity. Final thing I want to say about that, the tuition hikes tend to hurt the middle class more, because if you're affluent, you can write a check. And frankly, if you're under $80,000, we can take care of you.
In terms of diversity, you've had to live with Prop 209, which was passed by voters in 1996. And, we've seen the numbers of especially Latino and African-American students below where they were back then, especially at campuses like UCLA and Berkeley. What impact has all that had on the school, and what difference does it make?
I think it's had differential impact. We have campuses like Riverside and Santa Barbara and Merced that are really diverse by almost any measure. But at the more competitive institutions, it's been more of a problem. But I think it's been negative, and we've told the Supreme Court that. And we've said affirmative action would be a useful tool. But my basic theory is a just society does not allocate things by race and ethnicity. That if we need Hispanics and Asians and Native Americans and African-Americans on our police forces. We need them in our boardrooms, in our banks. We need them in political office. Every aspect of American life ought to be integrated, and power ought to be distributed and wealth across all these groups, probably never evenly, but at least on a non-discriminatory basis. And education is how you get there, and we're not getting there yet.
Any regrets at all around the way the university handled either Berkeley or Davis, the Occupy protests?
I think Chancellor Kotei and others would say, well, I wish we had handled it better on the Davis campus, and I wish they had. And it's always dangerous to speak for Berkeley, but I think there are some in Berkeley who would say, I wish we had handled some of those protests differently, and I agree with them. By the way, I don't want to overstate this. There were a lot of provocations, but at the end of the day, the university administration is supposed to be the adult in the room. So I'm not saying they weren't provoked. I mean, I was locked in a building for hours at Riverside with a riotous crowd outside. So I don't say everyone else is innocent, but at the end of the day, the people of California rightly expect us to handle it well, and they shouldn't be blaming the students or the people coming in to protest. They judge us more, and that's okay, and we could have done better.
I wonder if you feel that the university is a better place than it was when you got here? I mean, you've had a lot of adversity. I mean, can you say with confidence and honesty that it's a better place than when you arrived?
You know, I think it is a better place, and it depends on your model. Look, it's not an era in which I announced $50 million programs. I consider the first victory is holding the place together. No mass exodus of faculty. We continue in the rankings to be among the seven of our institutions are in the top 50 universities in the world. And we've improved the graduation rates. We've reduced the time to degree. I'm not saying it's a sea change, but I think we kept it on the right trajectory. And the last thing I would emphasize is the relationship between the Board of Regents and the president was very uneasy when I arrived. And I think the relationship is really very solid and very positive today. That will help Secretary Napolitano be a success here.
You are going to have some extra time, although I know you're going to go to teaching now and in law school. What are you going to do with that extra time besides relax?
Well, I think right now I'm in a mode I've said yes too often in my life and overscheduled myself. So right now, for a little bit, I'm taking some time to unpack the boxes and figure out what I want to do.
President Udoff, thanks so much for your service to California, and thanks for chatting.
Scott, thanks very much. Enjoyed it.
Responding to crime is the backbone of police work, right? You know, tracking down the bad guys when crimes are reported. But in Los Angeles, the LAPD is trying to get ahead of criminals, and now they're using software for what they call predictive policing, anticipating where crimes are likely to happen before they occur. Aaron Mendelson brings us the story.
Police Sergeant Tom Gary sits in his black and white patrol car. He's outside the Foothill Division station at the northern edge of Los Angeles, and he's shuffling through a stack of maps.
These squares, according to the computer system, there's a high probability that a crime will occur within one of those squares.
Now, Gary is one of the officers using predictive policing software. It takes crime data, runs it through an algorithm, and then generates these maps. The maps tell police where crimes might happen before they take place. The LAPD say predictive policing has helped reduce crime here in the Foothill Division. Predictive policing started 7 years ago at UCLA. There, academics and police officers started using math to study crime. One of the mathematicians discovered an equation that transformed the project. His name is George Moeller.
This equation here, on the left, you have lambda of t, x, and y. So lambda is essentially the rate at which events occur, so that could be for earthquakes or crime.
What he's getting at is that earthquakes and crimes work in a similar way. According to his model, one crime sets off a wave of crimes in an area, like how an earthquake sets off a wave of aftershocks. The equation uses basic details from police reports, like times, locations, and types of crimes that have already happened.
The idea would be, after that initial report gets filed, then the model says, hey, there's a risk of after crimes or aftershocks. And then the police go into that area, and then they prevent those second and third crimes from occurring.
That means burglaries, car break-ins, and stolen cars. Mueller carefully points out that his algorithm predicts property crimes, but it doesn't predict who will commit them. Not like the movie Minority Report, he says, where people are arrested before they ever commit a crime.
Mr. Marks, by mandate of the District of Columbia Pre-Crime Division, I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder of Sarah Marks and Donald Dubin.
Once the UCLA team had this formula, they went to the LAPD. And in November 2011, they started testing the algorithm out in the real world. The team worked closely with a police captain.
My name is Sean Malinowski, and I am the area commanding officer for Foothill area in Los Angeles.
Malinowski says the predictive policing test was effective.
In burglary, we had a 25% decrease in crime when you looked at it versus the 6 months the year prior. When you think about it, that's over 100 people that were not burglarized.
He says he's excited about the software, and his division uses it on every shift. But predictive policing raises potential problems. Andrew Ferguson teaches law at the University of the District of Columbia.
There's an accountability problem, there's a transparency problem, and there is a recognition that because all of the information is controlled by the police and the police department, it's very difficult and very unlikely that they will give up that information.
And it's unclear if spotting a person in a predictive box can lead to reasonable suspicion. Ferguson says the courts will have to decide that. Back at the LAPD's Foothill Division, Sergeant Tom Gary drives me around some of the predictive boxes. His cruiser passes auto body shops and Mexican grocery stores. This police division has a fraught history. The officers who beat Rodney King in 1991 were from the Foothill Division. Today, the LAPD says there's lots of police work to do here, including keeping tabs on 18 separate gangs. Gary says predictive policing is part of that. It's not perfect, and at one of the boxes, we end up looking at an open lot full of horses.
So it's very difficult when you tell the officer, you need to go in this box right here and spend some time in this box, and you're there, and you look around, and there's nothing.
I asked him if police officers have doubts about the technology.
They do not have doubts, but they like to arrest people. And if you put them in a box like that, and when there's nobody to arrest, but, you know, nothing to do but look at trees, it's my job to send the message to them that, hey, you're there to prevent crime. You're not necessarily there to arrest somebody. You're there to prevent the crime.
And the academic team says their algorithm is doing just that. They formed a company called PredPol. A handful of police departments around the state use PredPol, like Santa Cruz, Alhambra, and Richmond. In San Francisco, police plan to implement PredPol by the end of 2014. And they're looking at a new feature, one that predicts gun violence in addition to property crime. For the California Report, I'm Aaron Mendelson in Los Angeles.
This report is part of the STEM Story Project with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation and presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Well, when it comes to oil production, California is no Texas, but the Golden State is actually number three among states extracting crude oil from the ground. And now the nation's largest refiner of oil wants to haul that crude by train to its refinery in the San Francisco Bay Area. And that has the East Bay city of Benicia concerned about safety and air pollution. KQED science reporter Molly Samuel has the story.
Sitting near the banks of the Carquinez Strait is Ed Russell's woodshop. He and his brother Jack build custom retail displays, elegant wine boxes, colorful wooden signs, and more exotic things, as Ed points out.
In a fancy sushi restaurant where the little sushi boats go, and then there's a little chopstick holder here, and it looks like a little bridge. Okay, this is the sushi bridge.
The company has been in the Benicia Industrial Park for more than 30 years.
Yeah, we've been here a long time.
Jack says the nearby Valero oil refinery has mostly been a good neighbor, but he's not happy with its latest proposed project. Currently, Valero gets its crude oil from pipelines and tanker ships. The $70 million project would also bring in oil by rail, which would allow it to source crude from the Midwest and Canada. The plan includes a new storage tank and equipment to unload up to 70,000 barrels of crude oil a day. That's almost half the daily capacity of the refinery. Two trains a day, each with 50 cars, would deliver the oil, which would replace some of the crude that currently arrives by ship. The Russells are concerned about the impacts on traffic because the tracks are on either side of their building and cross their driveway.
And it doesn't just affect me. It affects all the businesses up and down here and all the people along the rail lines all the way back to the source.
Caltrans has weighed in, too, with fears that the long, slow-moving trains crossing near off-ramps could back traffic up onto Interstate 680. But traffic is just one of the issues locals have raised.
If you have an accident or you spill this stuff, how are you going to clean it up?
Marilyn Bardet is the founder of the Good Neighbor Steering Committee, the Valero Watchdog, as she describes it. She sits on Valero's community advisory panel. She's among those who lobbied successfully for a full environmental review.
Where does it begin? Where does it end?
The tracks go through Sassoon Marsh, the largest brackish marsh on the West Coast, and a delicate wildlife habitat. There are safety concerns. Earlier this summer in Quebec, a train carrying crude oil derailed and exploded, killing 47 people. The Federal Railroad Administration has set rules to help prevent that type of accident from happening here, but Bardet says it's been on her mind. And there's perhaps the biggest question of all. What kind of crude will be coming in?
All crudes are not created equal.
Brant Olson is a campaigner with the Natural Resources Defense Council in San Francisco. He says Valero has hinted to its investors that it wants to start bringing in crude from Canada's tar sands, also known as oil sands. That oil is heavy, and environmentalists say exceedingly dirty. It contains heavy metals, and the chemicals used to dilute it for shipment can be toxic, too. Olson says it also takes more energy to refine it, so there are more greenhouse gas emissions. Environmentalists hope to stifle the refining opportunities for tar sands crude because of the climate implications of burning all that oil.
If you're taking in dirty oil from Canada on the front end, you're going to have more pollution in Benicia out the back end, and that's really our concern.
There's no such thing as dirty oil or clean oil. I want to be very clear about that.
Bill Day is a spokesman for the San Antonio-based Valero. He won't say where the crude would be coming from, nothing more specific than North America. He claims that no tar sands are currently being processed at the Benicia refinery, but
it's set up to process a wide variety of crudes.
Many Benicia residents support the project. Valero is a big employer. It gives to local charities, and its taxes represent a fifth of the city's general fund. The Bay Area Air Quality Management District is reviewing Valero's application.
On a conceptual basis, I don't see how those emissions can possibly increase.
Jim Karras is the director of engineering for the Air District. He says Valero is already close to the limit of what it can put in the air.
Our rules don't allow it. Our conditions don't allow it. Our monitoring will verify it. So I don't see how that could happen.
And if it did happen, would you catch it?
We would absolutely catch it, and there would be significant consequences.
The Air District has installed monitors in and around the refinery, Karras says, and inspectors go out and do tests. But Marilyn Bardet says the coverage is spotty.
They do not have other monitors in town.
And she says the Air District measures pollution over time, focusing on averages and missing the impacts of emission spikes or accidents. This would be the first major crude-by-rail project in Northern California. Some other refineries in the state already use rail, including Tesoro in the Bay Area and Phillips 66 in Los Angeles. But Day says he wouldn't be surprised if others are looking into it.
This is not just a California thing, and it's not just a Valero thing. This is a phenomenon that we're seeing across the country.
The city of Benicia is studying the impacts of the project. Its planning commission is expected to make a decision on it in December or January. For the California Report, I'm Molly Samuel in Benicia.
This year is the 300th anniversary of Father Junipero Serra's birth. He created those Spanish missions up and down the California coast, and his legacy is complicated and controversial. All of it is explored in a new exhibit at the Huntington Library near Pasadena. The California Report's L.A. Bureau Chief Stephen Cuevas got a sneak preview.
One of the more than 200 objects in the exhibit is a painting commissioned by the Catholic Church 25 years ago on the occasion of Junipero Serra's sainthood. The Franciscan priest stands heroically atop a hillside, gripping a wooden staff below a fire-orange sky. It's a portrait that's quite unlike the man who actually landed in Baja California some 250 years ago. The Spaniard was healthy enough for a man of 55, but he was also skinny, asthmatic, and prone to illness. Yet he burned with ambition.
He served those interests of the Spanish crown: economic exploration, acquisition of new territory, creation of new citizens for Spain that they could tax and raise its revenue. But those weren't Serra's interests.
UC Riverside professor Stephen Hackle is curator of the exhibit and the author of Junipero Serra, California's founding father.
His personal desire was to convert Indians to Catholicism.
Junipero Serra and the Legacies of the California Missions is the first major exhibit to explore Serra's life, from his days as a young Spanish priest to his controversial role as one of California's founding fathers. Some of the story is told in Serra's own words, through letters and diaries written during his evangelical quest.
And he says in translation, they go entirely naked, like Adam in paradise before the fall. And of course, that's just Sarah imagining this untouched world that he thinks he will easily remake into one of beautiful missions with Indians singing Catholic songs and farming in the fields. And this, of course, is his total, this is his imagination.
And their view of him?
What we know is that upon first contact, most Indians simply fled from the presence of the Spaniards.
Some fled. Others surrendered and were converted. Sometimes, says co-curator Catherine Goodis, under intense coercion.
The example that we have in the exhibition is a line illustration of what's called a hobble, which would have been to punch people but to still enable them to work in the fields. So it would have hobbled your feet.
But many Native Americans lashed out at the missionaries. Another, much bloodier painting depicts the massacre at San Saba, where hundreds of Comanche warriors destroyed a Catholic mission in Texas, killing eight people. One of Sarah's missionaries was also killed in an attack in San Diego. Stephen Hackle says the violence was a turning point for Sarah.
Sarah writes in his letters, still with great faith that Indians would be converted, but also a wariness that they could turn on the Padres like tigers and kill them. So he lets go of this Adam and Eve image and has a much more realistic understanding of the challenges the Spaniards faced and the resilience of Indian culture.
A culture, says Hackle, that Sarah either could not or did not want to see. But the exhibit allows us to see, exploring the myriad ways in which Indians wove, sometimes literally, Spanish and Catholic influences into their own traditions, like basket weaving.
So even the basket on the left, it follows Chumash traditional patterns and production. If you look inside, though, there are crosses woven in. It's interlaced with a Catholic iconography so that it can be deployed for different purposes, though it's still following Native tradition.
Another installation memorializes the roughly 80,000 Native people baptized by the missionaries. A video projects their names one by one on a wall in the Huntington Central Gallery. It shows the year they were baptized, the year they died, and the Indian name they came to the mission with. Today, these birth records are a valuable tool for Native Americans to trace their lineage and secure federal recognition.
It's also a means of being able to discern other elements of Native tradition. So, for example,
Catherine Goodis points to an old Catholic prayer card in phonetic Chumash, one of many Native languages spoken in California at the time, but that is now nearly lost.
And there's a recording here by a woman named Ernestine DeSoto from Santa Barbara, whose mother was the last Native speaker.
Oh, there at Mission San Gabriel, my great-great-grandfathers and grandmothers were baptized about 1789, 1785.
Andrew Salas is one of the Native people featured in a film playing at the exhibit. It's about the long-lasting impact of Sarah and the mission system on Indian culture. He's the chairman of the nearby Gabrielino Band of Mission Indians.
We don't go to church every day or anything like that, but the relationship we have there is the remembrance of our ancestors, and my role is to carry the legacy of our history, to spread the word of our true identity.
Junipero Serra and the Legacies of the California Missions is on view at the Huntington Library through early January. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. The director is Susie Racho. Our technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes David Weir, Lisa Pickoff-White, Chad McClymans, and David Marks. Our interns are Carly Naren and Rachel Marcus. The editorial team includes Victoria Malleon, Ingrid Becker, and Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.